Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the health report and explorations, coming up after As It Is.
Let's do it again. Hello and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington with the program that helps you learn and improve your American English. You will also learn about important events that are happening around the world. Today, we travel to the African nation of Mozambique to hear about efforts to stop children from getting married. Then, we will give you a bit of science news about earthquakes. Experts may be able to predict where they are most likely to happen, but will the future quake be just a rumble or will it be a killer? There are some new developments you will want to hear. So if you're ready, let's get started with part one. The African Union has sworn to stop all child marriages within a generation. Yet the African nation of Mozambique has one of the highest rates of child marriage in the world. Strong social and cultural traditions support the practice, although it is illegal. Early marriage compromises the right of girls to an education. It can also have a shocking effect on their health. Katie Weaver tells us more.
Near the town of Pemba in northern Mozambique, 16-year-old Rachel plays with her daughter. Rachel is not the girl's real name. The young mother did not want to be identified. She also asked not to be recorded. Rachel got pregnant when she was 14 years old. She told VOA, "My big sister warned me to stay in school. There are many here who have babies at a young age, but normally they leave school to get married and continue to have children every year after that. Some think marriage is a guarantee of security." Rachel's story is not unusual in Mozambique, where 52% of girls marry before they are 18. Ceremonies with dancing and music mark the beginning of the mostly secretive initiation rites season in Pemba. Girls are removed from school when they have their first menstruation, the bleeding that is part of a woman's monthly period. The girls spend days, weeks, or even months being taught traditions by the matronas, female community leaders. The local school calendar is organized in a way to support the custom. The matronas teach the traditions to prepare girls for married life in Mozambique. They train them to be obedient to men. They teach them about cooking and other duties related to home and family. The matronas also train the girls in how to interest a man sexually. The initiation rites may also include removing part of the girl's genital organs. This is done in the belief that it will increase male sexual pleasure. Girls are considered ready for marriage once they have completed the initiation activities. Girls Not Brides is an organization working to end child marriage. Françoise Maduthe is the group's Africa regional officer. She says child marriage often forces girls to leave school. She says the girls also often have babies before their bodies have grown enough to support healthy reproduction.
Most often expected to enter into sexual intercourse very early before her body is ready. She's also very often expected to have children, to prove her value as a wife and a mother. And the consequences of early pregnancy for a girl, especially the youngest child brides, are really dramatic. Girls who are married before age 15 are 5 times more likely to die or be injured in childbirth than girls over age 19.
Naredzaya Gomozavanda is the African Union Goodwill Ambassador for Ending Child Marriage. She says child marriage is a violation of the fundamental rights of girls. She believes that child marriage can be ended within a generation if governments, women, and youth movements work together with religious and traditional leaders.
Getting into a marriage should not be an option out of poverty. It's important that our girls have access to education, and not only primary education, but are able to transition into secondary and tertiary and get decent jobs or are involved in some entrepreneurship. We need to also address some of the very strong patriarchal attitudes, where girls are seen as wives and not just seen as citizens. Girls are not getting married to boys. Girls are getting married to adult men who are supposed to be responsible.
Ms. Gombo-Zavanda says current social traditions in Mozambique to prepare girls for womanhood should be changed, not banned. She says training should involve skills that will help girls avoid dependence on marriage alone. Slowly, attitudes are changing in Pemba. Education has improved, and increased media availability is expanding the flow of information. I'm Katie Weaver.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Scientists know where earthquakes are likely to take place, but it is difficult for them to predict how strong an earthquake will be. Now, American researchers have found that it may be possible to predict the strength of future quakes. Ashley Thompson has more.
The Earth's crust, the outermost surface, is made up of large tectonic plates. As many as 20 tectonic plates cover the Earth. They move slowly, sometimes sliding under one another. Where that happens, earthquakes can take place. Timothy H. Dixon is with the University of South Florida. He is a geologist, a scientist who studies rocks and soil to understand the Earth. He and other scientists are using Global Positioning System, or GPS, equipment to measure what he calls slow slip events. By that, he means slow-moving earthquakes that cannot be measured by other instruments. Timothy Dixon says that while such movements may not be felt, they can lead to large, sometimes deadly, earthquakes.
They're the kind of earthquake that made the big Japan earthquake in 2011 and the Sumatra earthquake and tsunami in 2004. So they can be the real killers. So what we think these slow slip events are telling us is they're letting off steam, so to speak, in areas of the fault. And if they let off enough steam, that part of the fault won't rupture.
The more of the fault that ruptures or breaks, he says, the more powerful the earthquake is. The scientists set up a number of GPS receivers 15 years ago in Costa Rica to measure these slow slip events, which take place only every year or two. The last one was 3 months before an earthquake in 2012. People always want to know when an earthquake is going to happen. This technology cannot predict that. But Timothy Dixon says knowing how strong the quake might be gives officials time to improve building codes and make other preparations.
You know, the earthquake is more or less inevitable, even if you don't know exactly when it's going to happen. Since you know it's going to happen and you know how big it's going to be, you can prepare accordingly.
A scientific paper presenting his findings was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Thank you for being with us today. This is VOA, the Voice of America.
The Health Report is next, followed by Explorations. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health Report. For much of 2014, health officials around the world have been guarding against Ebola virus. There is another disease that can cause as much attention and fear, the plague. Last week, the World Health Organization reported on cases of plague in the island nation of Madagascar. WHO officials warned the disease could spread throughout the country. Madagascar's health ministry reported in November that the plague has killed nearly 50 people, and it said over 130 people are thought to be infected. Just the word plague alone calls up images of the Black Death hundreds of years ago. The Black Plague killed more than 25 million people in medieval Europe. Madagascar is far from that number. But the World Health Organization reports that the plague could infect many people. So, the WHO is working with health officials in Madagascar to contain the outbreak. The plague is not new to Madagascar. It seems to reappear in the country every year. However, the WHO's Kristen Lindmeier says the UN Health Agency is very concerned about this outbreak. He says the number of cases of plague appears to be higher than in recent years. Mr. Lindmeier says the disease could spread quickly because of the city's high population and the weakness of the healthcare system. Another problem is that the insects spreading the disease are becoming resistant to the chemical product designed to kill them. Christian Lindmeier says measures for the control and prevention of plague are being put into effect in the affected areas. He says a WHO expert has gone to Madagascar to work with the health officials there.
Plague can be a very severe disease in people with a case fatality ratio of 30 to 60% if left untreated. Plague is caused by the bacteria Yersinia pestis, a zoonotic bacteria usually found in small animals and their fleas. People infected with plague usually develop flu-like symptoms after an incubation period of 3 to 7 days.
Humans bitten by an infected flea usually develop a bubonic form of plague. It causes the swelling or enlargement of lymph nodes. If the bacteria reach the lungs, the patient develops pneumonia. The disease can spread from person to person through infected droplets spread by coughing. Bubonic plague can be successfully treated with antibiotic drugs if caught early. But the WHO says pneumonic plague is one of the most deadly infectious diseases. It can kill patients within 24 hours after infection. To date, WHO says only 2% of reported cases are of the pneumonic form. I'm Anna Mateo.
Thank you.
I'm Steve Ember.
And I'm Barbara Klein with Explorations in VOA Special English. Today, we tell about a large national park established to protect the culture of ancient Native Americans. It is called Mesa Verde.
It was cold that day in 1888 in southwestern Colorado. Richard Wetherill and his brother-in-law were trying to find some missing cattle. They were up on Mesa Verde. Spanish explorers had named the area. The high, flat mountaintop is covered with many green juniper and pinyon pine trees. It looks like a huge green table, which is Mesa Verde in Spanish. The two men came to the edge of a deep canyon. Through the falling snow, they saw what looked like a small city across the canyon. It was suspended in the middle of the rock wall. There were many connected rooms built into a natural opening in the rock. They named the ruins Cliff Palace. In the next few days, they found two more large ruins. They named one Spruce Tree House. They named the other Square Tower House.
A number of other people had seen and taken pictures of some of the cliff dwellings earlier, but the Wetherill family was the first group to study them. Soon after his discovery, Richard Wetherill returned to Mesa Verde to the ruins that had remained silent and untouched for centuries. Richard Wetherill collected many objects. It was an easy task. It looked as if the people who had lived there had just walked away, leaving everything they owned. Cooking pots by the fireplaces, food bowls on the floors, shoes in the corners, sticks for digging by the doors. The ruins in Colorado had been home to the ancestors of the present-day members of the Pueblo tribes. They were named Anasazi, or Ancient Ones, by the Navajo Indians. They moved to Mesa Verde about 1,500 years ago and left 700 years ago. They built the cliff dwellings in Mesa Verde toward the end of the 800 years they lived there.
Richard Wetherill showed his collection of objects in nearby towns. People were not interested. Just some more old Indian things, they said. Finally, he sold his collection to the Colorado Historical Society. But the Wetherill family continued exploring Mesa Verde. Their finds became known in the eastern United States and in Europe. Hundreds of people went to Mesa Verde to see for themselves.
One of the earliest visitors was a young man from Sweden, Gustav Nordenskiöld. Mr. Nordenskiöld spent months exploring the area. He traveled on foot and horseback. He took pictures that were published in a book, The Cliff Dwellers of the Mesa Verde. Gustav Nordenskiöld collected hundreds of objects he found in the ruins. He loaded them on teams of mules and sent them to the nearby town of Durango, Colorado. Local officials tried to prevent him from removing so many objects, but there were no laws to stop him. Mr. Nordenskiöld shipped the objects to Sweden. Later, they were given to the National Museum in Helsinki, Finland, where they remain today.
Many people were shocked by the continuing removal of objects from the ruins at Mesa Verde. One was a woman named Virginia McClurg. She had visited the area and had explored a few small ruins. From 1887 to 1896, she campaigned throughout the country to get laws to save the cliff dwellings. She gave speeches describing the destruction of the dwellings by people seeking treasures. She worked for years with members of the United States Congress to get such laws passed. Finally, on June 29, 1906, President Theodore Roosevelt signed a bill creating Mesa Verde National Park. It was the first national park designed to protect the works of humans. Then Congress approved the Federal Antiquities Act of 1906. The act helps protect ancient ruins on federal lands.
Today, from a distance, Mesa Verde appears as it did centuries ago. It rises more than 540 meters above the floor of the valley. Visitors can drive up to the top of Mesa Verde on a winding mountain road. When you reach the top, you are 2,400 meters above sea level. In the distance are the flat lands and mountains of the Four Corners area. That is where the western states of Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Arizona meet. This area has one of the largest numbers of archaeological sites in the United States.
Within the national park are more than 5,000 ruins from the time of the ancestral Puebloan people. 600 are cliff dwellings. Most of the ruins remain unexplored. Some have been uncovered and supported to make them safe to visit. These ruins are open to the public during most of the year. During the winter, activities are limited. The visitor's center at the park is open during the summer. The museum is open all year. The visitor's center and the museum provide information about the history of the culture of the ancient Pueblo people and about present-day Indians. National Park Service guides lead visitors to the ruins. They give talks about the cultural history of the area, and they talk about the geology and wildlife.
Some of the ruins in the Four Corners area are from the earliest people who lived there. They were hunters and gatherers, now known as basket makers. The basket makers lived in simple caves. Their civilization existed 2,000 years ago. The first evidence that ancient people had moved to Mesa Verde is from about the year 500. Those people lived in pit houses. Pit houses were large holes in the ground with roofs of wood and mud. In about the year 750, the early Pueblo people began building square structures of large connected rooms, or pueblos, above ground. Finally, in about 1100, they climbed down the canyon walls and began building cliff dwellings. Today, visitors to Mesa Verde can see some of the remains of all four kinds of settlements.
Thank you. Cliff Palace is the largest cliff dwelling in Mesa Verde and also in North America. It has 150 rooms. It is difficult to get to it. Visitors must climb down into the canyon on a narrow path with many steps. They must also climb down several ladders. But the trip is well worth the effort. Visitors can examine a huge and beautiful structure made of stone and clay. Spruce Tree House is the third largest cliff dwelling in Mesa Verde National Park. It has 114 rooms. It also has 8 underground rooms called kivas. The Indian men gathered in the kivas for special ceremonies. About 100 people lived in this cliff dwelling during the 13th century. Spruce Tree House is the easiest cliff dwelling to visit. The path curves down into the valley and then up to the ruin. Signs along the path point to trees and plants used by the ancestral Puebloan people. Also along the path are the juniper and pinyon pine trees that make Mesa Verde green.
About 500,000 people visit Mesa Verde National Park each year. The park's archaeologists have recovered many objects that the ancient Pueblo people used, including pots, tools, and jewelry. Many of the objects are shown in the visitors' center. However, human remains or any object from a grave may not be touched or shown. This is to honor the wishes of the modern Puebloan people who live in the area today. Mesa Verde National Park occupies 21,000 hectares of land. However, only about 10% of the area has been explored.
Mesa Verde is recognized as a special place. The United Nations named it one of the first World Heritage Sites in 1978. Special events were held at Mesa Verde during its 100th anniversary in 2006. They included tours of areas never before open to the public. Today's Pueblo Indians, whose ancestors lived in Mesa Verde, consider it a sacred place. And for visitors from around the world, it remains a place of mystery and beauty.
This program was written by Marilyn Cristiano and Shelley Gollist. It was produced by Mario Ritter. I'm Barbara Klein.
And I'm Steve Ember. Join us again next week for Explorations in VOA Special English.